For those who don't know, the Really Awful Movies podcast is largely improvisational and extemporaneous. In the case of this film here, I think I was kind of deliberately vague about the big climax of this one, because I didn't want to give away too much and do a disservice to what is a pretty stellar effort here. I also forgot the name of the lead, which is David, I hope I'm getting this right, Dastalmachian, who's best known for his work on The Dark Knight and in the Ant-Man franchise. So anyway, that said, without further ado, hope you enjoy the show.
Top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die. Only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now. But I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies podcast, a celebration of genre cinema.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 459 of the Really Awful Movies podcast, Late Night with the Devil. Now, for me, if you want to talk about old-timey mediums that really resonated, it was more the likes of radio. So when I was a young kid, I was really, really fascinated with this British show called My Word, which was all about the etymology and origin of words. And I think that in part inspired me to get into journalism and has no doubt helped inform how I became a writer. So it was that. And, you know, I would listen closely to the speaker. And then as I got older, I started gravitating towards strange late night conspiracy radio. Even though I never bought into any of the nonsense, I really enjoyed the way that some of these characters and late night hosts were able to weave wonderful tales. Like even someone like a lunatic like Alex Jones, is just his ability to spin something out of nothing, almost like a jazz musician. It's unbelievable, his improvisational nonsense skills, if you want to call it that. And I think Art Bell was one of the guy's names. There's these overnight shows where people would talk about mysterious happenings out in the desert, or the likes of, let's say, a Bohemian Grove, that secret society that would meet, featuring all these luminaries and political leaders, something that's actually referenced in this very movie itself. And then I gravitated to an overnight show that was a pop culture and counterculture that began at like 1 o'clock, and I would set my alarm to it and listen from like 1 to 4 in the morning. And the host of which was actually a guy I worked for on the CBC later on. So Canada's a national broadcaster. So it was weird how that turned out. And years later, I ended up working on a TV show. But that show was all about Simpsons trivia and Dukes of Hazzard chat and bizarre pop culture ephemera and wrestling and luchador and action movies and all sorts of weird things with whoever was up at the time. It almost had like a college radio spirit, but was on a mainstream radio. So when it comes to late night television, it's not something that I've been utterly consumed with, although I did go see a taping of David Letterman, and it was kind of weird. The artifice of having these very, very close microphones to the audience so they could pick up every bit of applause, and then getting instructed and getting this sort of breakdown by the producers of how you're supposed to act when you go into the studio. And I distinctly remember one of the characters in a headset saying, if you guys have a good show, Dave will have a good show, or something to that effect, so that you were part and parcel with the audience. Now, here there's a show called Night Owls, and it features obviously an owl, and it's a great name for a show, right? And it immediately had me thinking of this Italian horror called Stage Fright, with this owl Minerva figure as well. So it was kind of neat, and both very theatrical. In that one, it was about the theater, and this one, obviously, about late night TV, which is quite theatrical, of course, as well, and whose luminaries were Jack Parr and Johnny Carson. And the character here is actually named Jack as a nod and as a tribute to that. And of course, he's got a sidekick, much in the way Johnny did. And so this is all trials and tribulations of this Jack Del Roy, host of the Night Owl show, who is a constant, also ran, as they put it in the movie, or second banana, or second tier Johnny Carson, even as he adopts a lot of Johnny's mannerisms, like sort of pulling at the collar when a joke bombs, it's like, yee, 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 you know, and that kind of thing. And it has this very, very fun, spirited, sepia-toned, wide lapel, obviously as was the style of the time, show that everyone's really involved with, which would feature a bunch of magicians and psychics and people involved in telekinesis and telekinetics and all this great goofy stuff that the medium was initially known for, but also the types of things where they would trot out the animal expert and bring out some weird creature that would elicit oohs and ahs from the audience. So all this bang on, very good stuff, and you don't need to be a fan of Bill Carter's seminal book, The Late Night Wars, to really follow along with this. This is really good stuff. Even as I alluded to earlier, Bohemian Grove, there is a reference to that, as there are many references to things that happened in the 70s. So you have stuff about Richard Nixon, and there's flashes of Charles Manson and all these kinds of things. So a few little debits for this otherwise really good film that was really too much about referencing all these signposts and touchstones in a way that really, really solid films like A Licorice Pizza or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood did not, with a few exceptions, like what was going on at the time, like the oil crisis or the Manson killings, obviously, in the case of the Quentin Tarantino effort. Putting that aside, if you put aside the extent to which they ape some of this culture and some of the stuff that a lot of people would be eminently familiar with, this one takes a slight turn and gives you something that wears its influence on its sleeve, but in other respects also creates something kind of singular and kind of neat as well. And it's not like it's alone in occupying the 70s as a horror space. I mean, Black Phone did it, Mia Goth and X did it, The Conjuring did it. But I think this one does it in a pretty neat way. And so what you have is Christu, of a mysterious ethnic origin psychic who's cold reading the audience and saying stuff like, do you know anyone named Peterson? And someone in the crowd would say, oh yeah, Peterman. Well, close enough. I mean, obviously this is how a lot of these mind readers, so-called, operate. And they obviously say, oh, do you have anyone, a male member of your family whose name begins with J, which is obviously going to happen, as for the time a John or a Jeff or a Jonathan would be so popular that you'd never hear trying to do a psychic reading of, do you have a family member whose name starts with a Y? Oh, yes, Uncle, you know, Yorick, or God knows what. Like, what would it even be, right? Uncle Yuri. So, yeah, speaking of Yuri Geller, I believe, with the spoonbender from the 70s, that type of character is sort of referenced here. But this is a neat one in that this Christu fellow has these incredible visions and is communing and communicating with the dead. His eyes roll back into his head in front of a live studio audience. And the way the interplay happens is so deftly handled between what the band leader and the cheesy second banana sidekick and the stuff like that. That they made sport of on something like the Larry Sanders show, but you know, obviously the Andy to the Conan here, and this is all expertly too set on Halloween night. So you have the second banana guy dressed as the devil, which is a little great double whammy of El Diablo, which is neat. So you have people in the crowd as well dressed up in appropriate garb as befits the Halloween season, and one guy in the audience is dressed like a skeleton, and the host gives him a good ribbing, like this kind of really fun entertainment, and it makes you realize that everyone really coalesced and galvanized around this kind of late night entertainment, probably in many respects because there was so few options. But by the same token, it was undeniable how much talent the likes of a Messrs. Like David Letterman, Jack Parr, like I still marvel at Johnny Carson. It was like the way he was able to work the crowd and work his guests. And someone like a Dick Cavett or somebody, like it was such a different, singular, specific time that this is a film that really didn't need to reference all these touchstones to be that obvious. But so Christu, Mr. Christu, collapses and shoots black goo out of his mouth, and they have a skeptic on who's much in the same vein, drawn upon the likes of an Amazing Randy, or one of these skeptics who at the time would take on Uri Geller and take him to task about his spoon bending and this kind of thing. And this created great drama and great fuel to try and get this guy into first place ahead of Johnny. So this is a really cool dynamic. Of course, the backstage producers, the drama, the stuff happening on stage as well, which is just really great, especially when you hear what happens to Mr. Christou later. And a really, really cool, pivotal turning point in this film that really keeps you guessing. And the kind of constant interlocution and battle between the forces of the spiritual and the intellectual, the skeptic turns, that was really something that was well done. Now, against this, you have this young girl who's a survivor of this sort of Branch Davidian-esque, Anton LaVey-esque cult, that they bring her out of this fire, and she's this survivor with lots of tales to tell. They put her in a chair with this conduit into the other world to have this amazing moment on live television where she effectively turns into Regan McNeil from The Exorcist and spills the beans, shall we say, in this one. And wow, this is this is something. I mean, there's a lot of chatter going on about Late Night with the Devil on Instagram, and this is how I came upon it. This is obviously streaming on Shudder right now, and anytime you have this chatter happening, I mean, there's people who are obviously going to be naysayers who just weigh in almost to the point of being purposefully contrarian to say, oh, this thing's garbage. And to the extent that it obviously pushes period buttons, yes, it is on that front, but you can't help but be drawn into just some amazing performances, specifically a really, really captivating turn by Ingrid Torelli, I want to say her name is, as this girl Lily, who survived this this cult compound, and then who is communicated with through the spirit realm in this really, you know, weird, like, I'm not even sure, I think it's sort of a paranormal a spiritualist who communicates with her somehow as she's strapped in to this chair. And it really is really very impactful. I mean, I really love this kind of stuff. I love all the telekinesis and the soothsaying, and a skeptic who's calling all of this just a bunch of really, you know, to quote Joe Biden, really, although not in the movie, but really a bunch of malarkey and a bunch of cynical nonsense, and calling really the crowds a bunch of credulous dupes, really, who will buy into anything. There's actually a neat scene where the skeptic pulls out a blade and says, I feel compelled by Satan, like, turn off the TVs, you don't want to witness this. And there's gasps of shock and awe, but then he just puts down the blade and says, like, you people, I mean, come on, it's ridiculous how you can buy into this stuff. And I love that interplay, not to mention the fact that there's some neat background, really, really important information about host Jack Del Roy, about his ex-wife who succumbed to cancer, and a sore point for him. And this is, I think, I want to say, I forget the actor's name who's in the lead here, Del, I don't want to butcher it, but he was also in The Dark Knight, and he's really, really compelling, and he's really good, and just envelops this kind of, very much like actually Johnny Carson, this sort of Midwestern everyman type figure. He almost bears a slight resemblance to Jonathan Ross, the English TV host, which is kind of weird, but it was sort of by way of Chicago. But that's kind of neat as well. The performances were really top drawer, and they really got down all the details just right in terms of the set and the mics and the carpeting and the graphics and just the crowd and the banter and the quips back and forth, and just the sort of leisurely, easygoing charm between Mr. Del Roy and his sidekick, and also his rapport with the guests, is something that is just really, really easy. By way of example, I watched something with Oscar Peterson, the famous jazz musician, talking to Dick Cavett, the late night talk show host, and Peterson was showing him all these kinds of ways you could interpret different jazz standards, and a very, very well informed character. Cavett was asking him very pointed and very brilliant questions about his craft, and it's almost impossible to think of this kind of thing happening now, sort of really in-depth, really, really intellectual, but accessible, intelligent, long-form discussion about jazz music. It's unheard of. Those were different times, to say the least. And someone like a Dick Cavett would be impossible, I think, to imagine today. I mean, as bright as some of these guys are, like a Conan or a Colbert or whatever, it's really about yucks at the end of the day. And with Cavett, it ran the gamut from all sorts of different people. For, I think, writers like a Norman Mailer or whoever would end up on his show, and he was able to accommodate all these different things instead of just being sort of a dance monkey dance, like a increasingly a drunken Jimmy Fallon, if the reports are to be believed. But yeah, it's one of these unique cultural instances and something that resonated with the broader public. So it's really quite cool to have a supernatural horror set against this environment and putting it in this very unique, specific place. And I think the best horror films are ones that are set in iconic locales and not ones that are spread all over. Like if you think of something like the Berlin Theater in Demons, for an immediate example off the top of my head, and it's such a, that signage and that auditorium and that theater just has so much resonance for that film, and you couldn't think of that film being anywhere else particularly. And I think that's why the sequel was not as successful, because you had that inside the cinema sort of appeal. It's something like popcorn as well. You could run the gamut of a bunch of films that are incredibly specific. I think, though I was not a fan, I would throw the first Saw into that realm as well. So this one has a lot going for it. Really, really talky. Really, really leisurely paced in a way that would, I think, conjure up, pardon the pun, something like The Omen, where it takes a while to get going but never feels boring or staid. It just keeps you, I mean, as it should. It should keep you entertained, because this is a medium of late night television that is meant to be entertaining, and this is what entertained the masses at the time. And having all these kinds of beats that would be interrupted by, you know, a makeup and commercial breaks, and then the discussions with producers about how to twist and turn the show to make things more engaging. I mean, all that stuff is just so great and so impactful in this one. And, you know, again, it's just all the little goings on and the subtleties happening backstage, and the worry on the face of Delroy as he's, well, I don't want to spoil it for those who haven't seen it, but there really is a lot going on. And when, you know, again, the turning point when the psychic Mr. Christou, something mysterious happens to him, and we find out that paramedics tending to him had some interesting things to find at the scene, this is when things take a turn. And this is when this thing really gets charged and really gets going. Although I think from the beginning onward, you can't help but be drawn in, because there's a lot of films that do 70s poorly, and when they're done well, as in the case of like a Licorice Pizza or Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, just to name a few, of course, Licorice Pizza being an extremely well done example. It's something that you brought into a different time and place, and it goes beyond just the simple, obvious, and the lesser lights that try and do things, just the stylistic quirks of a wide lapel. It goes beyond that to just really, really living and breathing the mid-70s as you do in this one. And it really is very, very impactful. Another thing I learned, and well, I mean, not that his takes on films can be, well, let's just say you can take them with a grain of salt, but Stephen King apparently called this film absolutely brilliant and that you couldn't take your eyes off of it. And then, you know, late last fall, obviously after it debuted at South by Southwest, it got picked up by the likes of IFC and Shudder for distribution rights beyond, I think, where it was, you know, these small pockets of geography where it initially was. And it's done booming business you know, for such a small little production that, you know, that you can't help but it really, I think, reflects, I think, how desperate, the desperate kind of yearning and deeply rooted desire there is to see something different and not, you know, the latest retread or the latest, you know, whatever they're going to do with the Halloween franchise or however they're going to reboot and reimagine, you know, Scream for the, you know, dozenth time. I mean, it's one of the few times, I think, where the review aggregator of Rotten Tomatoes gets everything pretty bang on, because while this one isn't, I think, one for the ages that will totally be mind-blowing, I think it could have potential to be so, at least, or to be fondly remembered years from now. And I think it immediately requires a second viewing by yours truly to that extent, because I don't know. I mean, there is a slight possibility I'll pick up more debits than I can think of offhand now as I podcast into the wee hours of the night. But I think for the most part, I mean, it's got all the stuff I really dig. Obviously, the you know, practical effects and puppetry and eschewing AI with a few exceptions. I really like just the talkiness and the sheer unbridled atmosphere and time and space. It's not the only recent horror, I think, to surpass this, although albeit in a different time period, would be Last Night in Soho, a superior effort in many respects, and much more horrific and darker and much more, like, I find the City of London especially compelling, and I was there in 2018, really, really felt how rich and historic and amazing London is. This one, obviously, it's not going to have that kind of a visual appeal, but that's not to say there isn't some neat stuff happening here too. I mean, this is one that's worth checking out. It remains to be seen how people view this one if they're not as familiar with the late night space as most people were who came of age during this time. Although obviously there's still the practitioners who are not since long retired, like a Conan O'Brien, and obviously Jimmy Fallon continues to ply his very tedious trade at this point. But this film wears its influences on its sleeve, but creates something a little bit different too. And I liked the pacing. I was really on board with everything. I'm on board with this too. I mean, I give this one a 3.5 out of 5, and it's well worth your time. Anyway, well, take care. Talk to you soon. Thank you.